Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our featured guest today is Chris Whittaker, talking about his novel We Begin at the End. We'll also hear from Sue Burge on her latest poetry collection, Confetti Dances, and we'll be chatting to Madeline Dewhurst about her debut novel, Charity. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but as I say on the show, we've got poetry, a literary fiction psychological thriller is how Madeline describes her novel. Your genre, it seems, very much crime and thriller.
I suppose it does-ish. I don't see We Begin at the End as a crime novel, necessarily. I know there's a crime in it, but I see it as like a coming-of-age story. It's kind of just a snapshot of a year in the life of a 13-year-old girl and the police chief in the local town that she lives in. And it's kind of a book about family and family bonds. I work in the library and I have to shelve it somewhere. So I shelve it in crime and I also shelve it in general fiction. I never know where to put it, but yeah, more so crime. Crime, I suppose, because I find it really interesting. You know, I'm a big crime reader. I've always read crime fiction since I was a kid. You know, Dennis Lehane and John Grisham and John Hart and authors like that. I just find it interesting, you know, when people are victims of crime, you know, the actual crime itself might take a few minutes, you know, it might happen very quickly. And then what happens afterwards can kind of dictate where your life heads and how you, you know, where you end up. And that's more what I'm interested in. You know, it's a very big selling in genre for a reason. And I think people like, you know, to look into it.
Yeah, I know what you mean about your novel. It's in a lot of crime novels, there's crime and then there are the repercussions of that crime. And in your novel, it's almost back to front in that everything seems to be leading to this crime.
Yeah, and it's hard to categorise. You know, it straddles genres. And when you write a book, when you kind of follow a character over a year in their life, like I've done, and We Begin at the End, it's hard to put them into a box and say that this is a crime novel. It's just a book that looks at someone's life. And the things that happen to Duchess, you know, fit into many different genres. Like, there is a crime involved. She is quite aggressive and... But she's also a 13-year-old girl getting ready for her first prom and first love, kind of, and very much, like I mentioned before, family, you know, and what it means and how the meaning of that word evolves for her throughout the story, because she begins the story with just a mother that can't really take care of her and a younger brother that's entirely dependent on her. And as the book goes on, you know, more people come into her life, whether she likes it or not. And she doesn't really like it, you know. She's very tough and she's very good at fronting. And so she resists and she kind of can't see beyond the immediate. And she's kind of been learnt from a young age not to rely on anyone but herself. So there is a wall up and it's very hard for her to break that, for other people to break that down. And she doesn't let them really.
Well, we'll be talking a lot about We Begin at the End, but let's hear your first choice of music. Is music important to you, Chris? I know it was torture for you, choosing just three tracks.
Well, it is really important. And this one, so my first novel, Tall Oaks, that someone has written a script for the first episode of Tall Oaks, and this song is playing at the very beginning of that episode. So I've listened to it a lot over the past few months, really. But it is, you know, it helps set the tone. I'm quite visual when I'm writing. I like to have lots of pictures up of the scene that I'm writing, and I like to listen to music that the characters might be listening to or might be playing in the background, and it helps.
That was Mr. Blue Sky by the Electric Light Orchestra, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Chris Whittaker. Chris's first novel, Tall Oaks, was published in 2016. The Mail on Sunday described it as a gripping debut. The Guardian called it an absolute delight, and it went on to win the Crime Writer Association's John Creasy New Blood Dagger Award. His second novel, All the Wicked Girls, came out a year later, followed by the book we'll be discussing today, We Begin at the End. It was, has been called, taking a deep breath here, a Guardian Best Thriller of the Year, an Express Best Thriller of the Year, an I Best Thriller of the Year, a Mirror Best Book of the Year, and a Waterstones Book of the Month. Mm-hmm. And for what it's worth, I loved it too. But you must have been delighted by all that.
I was. It was a long time writing this book, and you never know how it's going to be received, you know, because it's not always, you know, the harder you work, the more people will enjoy it or see that you've worked really hard on it. But it did, you know, the early reviews were good and people just seemed to get it. And I knew that the book would kind of live and die on Duchess, the lead character, and whether people warmed to her or not even necessarily liked her, just cared about her story. And they seemed to. So it was really nice. There's always this funny moment because I finished writing the book sometimes a year before it comes out. And, you know, you're expected to get on with the new book or begin the PR commitments and things, but you still don't really know if people are going to like the book or not. So it was a relief more than anything. And it was very nice. Yeah.
And for people who haven't read the novel, what's it about?
So it's about a girl called Duchess and about a policeman named Walk. And they don't really sound like they've got a lot in common, but they live in the same small town in Southern California. And they're very much alone and very much trying to outrun this this terrible event that happened 30 years before, where Duchess's aunt died as a little girl. And the book opens with that scene. So it's not a spoiler or anything like that. And then we skip ahead 30 years and we find out that the characters involved in that death, in the death of a child, it's kind of shaped their whole lives. And it very much has shaped Duchess's life, even though she was born long after the event, because her mother is deeply affected by it and has struggles with alcohol abuse and drug use. And her mother's boyfriend is a man named Vincent King, and he was responsible for the death of the child at the start of the book. And so he's been in prison for 30 years, and we pick up with him coming home. You know, so he spent the bulk of his life in prison, and Duchess knows that this man was once close to her mother. So she's terrified that he's going to come back into their lives and kind of wreck everything. And it's so fragile, their situation, that she decides to take action. And in doing so, she kind of sets off this chain of events that shapes what happens over the next year in her life. And then on the flip side, we have Walk, who is on the surface very happy and very well-rounded. And, you know, he's the chief of police in a town that doesn't really need policing because it's this sleepy town that nothing much happens in. But he too is, you know, he was there at the beginning of the book when this child died. And so he spent his whole life waiting for Vincent, who was his childhood best friend, to come out so he can kind of pick up where he left off. But life doesn't really work like that. So he finds a very different Vincent comes out of prison. And he's also sick. And the town kind of mirrors him because the town is slipping away because a lot of the houses are built on the edge of a cliff, and every so often the water comes in and erodes some of the cliff and claims one of the houses. And we follow them over a year.
And Cape Haven, where it's based in California, is this based on a real place? I looked it up. It felt very real. I mean, it seemed clear to me that you knew exactly where you were in that town. Or do you have a map of it somewhere written down in your head?
Yeah, so I start with a real area and then I build a fictional town. And I wanted to build this town that was perfect 30 years ago. And so I began constructing it. And I work in the library and use a lot of the resources there. So I'll spend, you know, years looking at maps and reading travel guides and studying the area where I think I want to put the town. And it slowly begins to take shape. And then I have an amazing American team at my US publisher called Henry Holt. They're just so talented. And so they catch my mistakes and things, but together we do a lot of work on it. It was just really important to me because it's so important in the story, that town. And then later on, Duchess goes to Montana. And so you have these two huge places in her life, you know, that it's all she's ever known. You know, she's kind of expected to just fit, and she doesn't fit at all because she didn't fit in the last town, and she's kind of always looking for home. Yeah, location's just so important to me. It's the same when I read a book. I generally prefer to read something that's set far away from where I live because I like the escapism of it. And when I sit down to write, I kind of need the same.
Yeah, why did you set it in America? Because you could have set it here.
There's a long story behind the book and where it came from. It kind of follows my journey of how I got into writing, and it's a strange one. And I was, when I was at school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I got really drunk before my economics A-level exam and didn't, and I missed the exam. And so I had the option of retaking or, you know, going out into the world and working. That appealed to me. Although I just, you know, when you're that age and you're expected to kind of choose a path, it's difficult, isn't it? It's a lot of pressure. Yeah. I mean, how do you know you want to do something for the rest of your life unless you give it a try first? So I went out and tried loads of different jobs and worked in a bar, lots of different bars, which I really enjoyed. And I sold electrical cabling and I worked in a bakery, which was great fun. And I was an estate agent and I was out dropping leaflets through people's doors in London. And someone came up to me and they were going to mug me for my phone. And I knew, I mean, he asked to borrow my phone, but I knew where it was heading. We had a fight and he pulled out a kitchen knife and stabbed me in the side three times. You know, when the adrenaline's going and you don't realise, I just thought he was punching me. And then I looked down, my shirt was covered in blood, and I dropped my phone and wallet and he picked them up and ran off. And I drove myself to hospital and then they stitched me back together again. And then everything went wrong after that. I had what I now know is PTSD, but didn't know anything about it at the time. You know, I didn't know why I couldn't sleep at night, or why I wasn't eating, or couldn't read a book or watch TV or do anything. And so that was a really tough time. I was hoarding painkillers and was going to do something really drastic, because this went on for about a year and I was in a really bad place. And I sat down to write my parents a note, and I had got a book from the library about kind of self-help therapy book. And it talked about a kind of therapy where you take the event that happened and you write about it, but you change the people involved to fictional characters. You change the location, you change the outcome if you want to. And I had this image of a girl, Duchess, you know, this was like 20 years ago when I was 19. And I wrote a scene with Duchess, which is a scene that is in the book now. It's the scene where her mum is singing on stage and being heckled by some people. And Duchess, she stands her ground and stands up for her mother. And I sat down and wrote that. And then I went to sleep and slept for, I think, about 6 hours, which was a miracle for me at the time. You know, I just used to lie awake thinking about everything that had happened. And I was drinking too much and taking drugs and doing things that I shouldn't, which didn't help. But writing got me through that night. I carried on writing kind of off and on, but it wasn't like, when I've talked about it before, it sounds like it was a quick fix, you know, and all of a sudden everything was okay. But it was far from that. It was, you know, I got drunk not long after and drove my car off the road and flipped it over and have a scar down my cheek from that. And my mum was very upset with me. But I didn't tell anyone. I didn't tell anyone why. She just thought I was being stupid, you know, drinking and driving. And I just wanted to maintain this. I'm okay. You don't need to worry about me. I don't want to be a burden on anyone. And I'm still bad at it now. You know, if ever anything is going wrong in my life, I don't talk to people about it. I just try and find a way, because I don't want my problems to become their problems. But I know that's not a healthy way of dealing with things.
But that is what Walk does in the book. When you're telling that story, so much of that story is in that novel, one way or the other, the idea of masculinity and hiding the things that are wrong.
Exactly.
Because he has Parkinson's and the past always being with you. It's all there.
It is. And Duchess was, you know, a mirror of everything I was feeling. You know, if I was angry, I wrote her very angry. If I was feeling like a victim or feeling lonely, you know, I made her everything for her 10 times worse. And it became like if she could get through it, you know, I could get through it. And it sounds silly that it's such a personal novel, because it's a book set in America about a 13-year-old girl, you know, so far from my life. But that it is intensely personal, the book, to me. So I carried on writing. Then I went on to work in the city, because I read an article about a stockbroker who had a Ferrari, and that was all I needed. You know, that was reason enough. I had a terrible CV as well, but they gave me, one of the companies took pity on me, because I went into the city with my CV and managed to get an entry-level job. And I worked as a stockbroker for years and was still drinking too much. You know, when I look back on it now, it kind of goes hand in hand with that environment. You know, it wasn't a healthy place for me to be working, but I really enjoyed it. And then I worked on a trading desk and lost a lot of money. I broke my trading limits and ended up in about £1 million of debt. And I was 24 at the time, and we were getting married, and the wedding costs were spiraling, because, again, I didn't tell anyone. But it was entirely my own fault. And, you know, they could have gone to the police over it, because I'd broken the law. And they gave me a second chance and said I could work the debt off if I carried on working for them and took responsibility for it and paid it off, you know, out of my own pocket. So I did that. But it's a tough thing when you're 24 and you're in that kind of debt. I went back to drinking too much and taking drugs, and things got really bad again. And I remember being so disappointed in myself. You know, I'd worked so hard to get through it the first time, and then I'd messed up again only like 5 years later. But I did, I paid it off, you know. It took years, and I carried on writing Duchess and Montana, and that would be my escape. You know, I would escape into writing. And then I read a book called The Last Child by John Hart, who is a brilliant writer. It's such a good book, that book. He was a lawyer and he quit his law job to become a writer, you know, and it seemed really inspiring. And then I started to give some thought to, you know, the only constant over the past 10 years of my life, the only thing that I've gone to do when things are hard, the only thing that I really enjoyed was writing. So I quit my job just before I turned 30. And my wife was pregnant and a student at the time. So it was all of a sudden we went from having quite a secure future. And, you know, by the time you're 30, I felt like I should have been on the path that I was going to stay on. But I just threw it all away, basically, just because I was so unhappy. And she was brilliant and very supportive. We sold our flat and car and changed our lives entirely and moved to Spain for a while, where I wrote Tall Oaks. And once I finished Tall Oaks, I began to look at how you become a writer, you know, how you need an agent. I didn't know you needed an agent. I didn't know how hard it was to get an agent. I didn't know how hard it was to get a publishing deal. I didn't know the odds are so stacked against you. Had I done, I might not have done it. I like to think I would have, but it might have been too scary. I was lucky in that I submitted to a few agents and they all wanted to meet me. So I flew back to London and signed with my agent that I'm still with now. Tall Oaks was published and then I wrote a second book called The Wicked Girls. And I had had a 2-book deal and then I signed another 2-book deal and had a bit of time between books and it kept calling out to me. Whenever I logged into my computer, I'd see that the file marked Duchess and it felt like there was some unfinished business. And at that point, I wanted to go back and see if I could finish the story. And I pitched to my editor this book about an outlaw. And I said, oh, it's about a teenage girl. She's got a gun. She's on a quest for revenge. And I made it sound very crimey. And I also said I could deliver it in 6 months. And and then 3 years later, they got a first draft of that book. And then 2 years after that, it hit the shelves. So it was a 20-year journey from first writing the character of Duchess to ending up on the bookshelf. That was a very long answer. And I still haven't answered your original question, why America? When that first happened, when I was stabbed and I was very, very unhappy, I looked back at the only time I could recall when I was at my, you know, truly happy, and that was on a holiday. My dad took us on, my parents divorced when I was quite young, and I'm really close with my dad, and I missed having him around every day. And he took me and my brother to Disney World in Florida, and it was the best time, you know, of my life. I just look back, even now I look back on it and just think I was truly happy, you know, in only the way a kid can be, when everything is the immediate. What's happening now? What am I going to enjoy? What am I doing today? And we were standing in line at Disney World and we met a family from Montana, got talking to them, and they kind of painted a portrait of the most beautiful town on earth, most beautiful state, and that stuck in my head. And they said it was like switching from portrait to landscape, which is a line that makes it into the book. Naturally, when I went to move my London stabbing story to somewhere else, I chose America because it felt like a place I could escape to and be happy in. It also happens to be a beautiful, amazing world within a country, you know, and I needed this big setting to tell this big story. And I needed Duchess to go on this. She goes on a road trip at the end of the book. And it's kind of this, it is a big, epic journey to kind of look for revenge. And it just, I don't think it would have worked anywhere else.
You got those scales as well. I suppose also the stakes are higher because of the death penalty, which you wouldn't have had if you'd have set it in this country. Because
exactly. Yeah. And Duchess, there's something about her that feels innately American. She has a toughness. And again, the gun thing, there's parts in the book where she gets to fire a gun. And I'm a big fan of Westerns and those sort of books, you know, Cormac McCarthy, and I've read loads of them. And I like the notion of outlaws. Duchess doesn't know who her father is in the book. She has to do a family tree, a project for school. So she's got her mother's side fairly well mapped out. And on her father's side, it's just a big question mark. On her mother's side, she finds a link in, she goes to the local library and finds a link to an outlaw. It's a tenuous connection, but she holds on to it. And, you know, when she needs to be strong, she declares herself an outlaw and the other kids make fun of her. But it gives her some kind of root. It gives her, you know, an excuse for the way she behaves. She's able to reason away the bad things she does by saying she's got outlaw blood. And I really liked it. And I like that image of her.
Thank you, Chris. So, well, you mentioned your debut novel there. Let's hear from Madeline Dewhurst now about her debut novel. Madeline's an academic in English and creative writing. Charity, her debut novel, came out last month. And when I spoke to Madeline, I asked her to tell me what it's about.
Well, it's set in London in 2015, and it's about mainly the relationship between two women. One is Edith, who is in her sort of early 80s, and Lauren, who is 19, who moves in with Edith because Edith doesn't want to move into a care home. She's no longer able to live alone. And Lauren, who's studying to be a beautician, needs somewhere to live in London and can't afford London rents. So this seems like the sort of perfect solution with Lauren moving in with Edith. But you discover as the novel goes along that there's actually more to it than that, and that perhaps their meeting isn't just by chance, that this isn't just a sort of random person that Lauren has chosen to move in with. There's a background, there's another thread of the novel which gets introduced slightly later, which is set during the 1950s in Kenya, during the Kenyan emergency. The largest tribe in Kenya is the Kikuyu, and they were fighting for independence from British rule. So that's also at the core of the novel.
And what was it about that period and that political moment that interested you?
I remembered in sort of 2013, and it was in the news that five elderly Kenyans had taken the British government to court because they had been detained and suffered torture during that period in the 1950s. I mean, they actually started their legal action in 2009, but it was almost thrown out because the government argued that it was historic, too much time had passed, but the judge allowed them to go ahead. It was very shocking to me that this had happened within living memory, and you had these people who had been treated so brutally. And William Hague did in the end come out and apologise to the thousands of Kenyans who had been detained and tortured. Perhaps naively, I thought this would bring about some sort of huge soul searching in Britain, and that we would really start to sort of address our colonial history and reevaluate what that meant. And then I was a bit taken aback. It just disappeared and that was it. And nothing more was said about it. It was one of those things, it wouldn't leave me alone. And I thought, this needs to go into the novel. I need to write about this. And I could only really do it indirectly because I'm not Kenyan. And I wanted to look at it from the perspective of Britain and Britain's involvement and what that means and the sort of legacy of colonialism.
And listening to you talk about the novel, what kind of genre are we talking here? Some sort of literary fiction, or is it a psychological thriller element, or...?
I think it's elements of both. I would say literary fiction, but also, and readers have all said to me they found it really gripping and quite a tense novel. It's definitely a sort of psychological thriller as well. Yeah, I find it tricky saying what genre it is.
And I love those novels that feature relationships between older women and younger women, because there's always a slight charge there, isn't there? There's always can be a charged relationship because of the differences for women now, young women now, and young women some time ago.
Yeah, that's very true. And that was sort of my initial impetus, was to explore that. And I really enjoyed doing that relationship between Edith and Lauren, which at times is sort of combative, but they actually become very fond of each other and they both learn a lot from each other. But yes, there's that completely different experience of life and what it's like to be young in the world now as opposed to 60 years ago.
This is your debut novel, so congratulations on that. What's been the route to publication for you?
I sort of started off approaching agents, and though I had some positive feedback, didn't get any takers. So then I sort of initially didn't realise, but there are a lot of publishers out there who are open to submissions, you know, not via an agent. And I used it was a really helpful Ms. Lexia directory to indie publishers. And I just said to myself, right, I'm going to write to one of them a day. And I was looking through and I was struck by Iron Lightning Publishers. And actually, it's interesting you were asking me about genre, because one of the things I kind of liked in the write-up from the text about them was that they would take submissions that didn't fit neatly into one genre. And I thought, oh, that sounds like the right place for me. So I sent the novel to them and was kind of amazed. I mean, it was the beginning of the first lockdown and I heard back from them very quickly, and they wanted me to do some rewriting and slightly changing. I initially had three first person narrators and that changed to two, and then a third person section, that was really my route to publication.
So working with an indie press, it doesn't sound that much different to working with a what we call a mainstream press. You're still working with a copy editor. You're still guiding and being involved in the production.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had my editor, Simon Edge, who was brilliant. And, you know, and he sort of said when they accepted me, well, your novel needs some work, but if you're willing to put in the time to do that, then we'd like to publish it. I worked with him and then a separate copy editor as well. I haven't published through one of the main sort of publishers, but I imagine it is pretty similar.
So how does it feel now seeing it actually in print and out there?
Really exciting. It's fantastic. And it's something I've sort of wanted for such a long time. Yeah, it's very validating. And it's great to sort of feel I can say now, yes, I am a writer without feeling I couldn't quite say that.
There is something about having something published, isn't there, that writers feel makes them a writer. Lots of writers say this, that it sort of moves you up a level or makes you take yourself seriously somehow.
Yeah, I think that's it. Exactly. It does make you take yourself seriously and feel, right, I can focus on this and this is my main occupation. And yeah, and I think it's been wonderful as well, just getting the cover and the design and seeing your work in a proper book format, that transformation from on your laptop out in the world. And having other people read it and getting good feedback as well is very exciting too.
And Charity by Madeline Dewhurst is published by Lightning Press. We're talking today on Bookmark to our featured guest, Chris Whittaker, about his novel, We Begin at the End. Chris, just to talk to you, and you sort of alluded to it a little bit, about the plotting there. It sounds like the novel was almost written piecemeal, bit by bit, scene by scene, when they came to you. But the parceling out of information, particularly in the novel, is done very cleverly. There's mysteries running through the first quarter of the book. We don't quite know why Vincent spent so long in prison or even what he's really there for. And then there's more information that comes out later and some bigger reveals at the end. How do you do that? How did you time that? Do you have a sort of equation for when we would find out this information because it would trigger how we felt about following information?
No, it's a mess, actually. You're right in that I write all of the books in the wrong order. You know, I sit down and if I feel in the mood to write the final scene, that's what I'll write. I don't write the first scene first because there's a lot of pressure on that first chapter. And why put yourself under that kind of pressure at the beginning? You know, you have to hook readers and all of that stuff. So I leave that for now and I concentrate on developing the characters. But yeah, there's no order to it. The plotting comes much, much later. I will write way more than I need to and then cut it back down. So characters that you might think are bit players in the story, I will have written almost a whole book with those characters in so that I get to know them and I get to know how they would react in a given situation. And it needs to feel right. And I'm a big believer in that. But there is no plotting at all, really. But with We Begin at the End, I knew how it would end from very early on. Duchess's mother tells her at the start of the book that selfless acts are what make you a good person. And it's kind of the only thing she teaches her daughter that sticks. And so I knew Duchess would spend the book hunting for this perfect selfless act. And I wanted her to find it at the end. Yeah, so I knew where I was going, but how I got there was, you know, it's this constantly evolving, changing thing, and certain ideas come to me. And my wife thinks I'm a bit crazy with it and a bit obsessive because I'll get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to change a sentence or a paragraph that doesn't feel quite right. And I'll write and rewrite and can spend a month writing a paragraph, easily a month.
I wanted to give a shout out to those minor characters, lesser characters, or the characters who take up less space.
Yeah.
The characters like Dolly, Thomas Noble, Hal, who even Peter and Lucy, who are in it very briefly, but you bring these minor characters to life. I love the fact Thomas Noble always gets his full name. Because some people
Thomas
in life
Noble.
Just do, don't they?
They do. And he deserves it.
He does deserve it, yeah. And there's a lot in the names of the characters. But that eye for characterisation, where does that come from?
Of the years I spent writing the book, a solid year goes on Duchess's dialogue alone and getting to learn. You know, I found a video, a website where you can listen to people speak and you can choose a town in America or anywhere in the world, really, and listen to people read transcripts. And you begin to pick up speech patterns. And so I did that with Duchess and I spent a year writing her dialogue. I need to feel like I know them before I can put them in the book, you know, or in the story. And it's the same with characters that you might think are bad. There's a character called Dickie Dark in the book that, for the most part of the book, takes a role where you think his intentions are dishonourable, and you know they might be, but you know, where is that coming from? I'm always of the belief that if you spend enough time with someone, it should be very difficult to put them in a box. When we're bombarded every day by news and we see the worst things that people have done or are likely to ever do in their life, you know, what is the story behind that act? You know, where does it come from? Who else are they? I find it really interesting, you know, that you have these terrible things done by people who on the surface haven't done anything like that before, you know, or might have had a difficult childhood, but there is normally a path that has led to that moment. And that's what I try and bear in mind with all of my characters. You know, they're not plot devices. To me, they are real people. They are deserving of their own slice of the story, however small it might be. And it's just so important to me. You know, when I'm reading a book, if you give me characters I care about and a beautiful sentence, you know, that to me is a brilliant book. You know, I don't much care what happens with them or, you know, with crime, there's a tendency to need to fool the reader and, you know, a book can live and die and it's twists and people go out of their way to guess that twist. And I get it and it's fun and I do it sometimes when I'm reading, but it's not really the sort of book I wanted to write or the sort of story I wanted to tell. You know, I wanted people to care about these characters in a way that I do.
I think you definitely achieved that.
Thanks.
Let's listen to your second choice of music now, which is Lynyrd Skynyrd and Sweet Home Alabama. Why this one?
This is because All the Wicked Girls is set, my second book is set in Alabama in the 90s, and I did a huge amount of research for that book and spent a lot of time mentally in Alabama. And the song just reminds me, you know, whenever I hear it on the radio, it takes me back to writing that book. Big wheels come on turning.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
In 1960s Cambridge, you might have shopped at Joshua Taylor, gone roller skating at the Corn Exchange, and seen the Beatles perform live at the Regal Cinema. On Sunday mornings, John Gannon takes you back in time with hits and memories from the swinging decade. John Gannon's 60s scene, Sundays at 8 a.m. on the station that's live and local, Cambridge 105 Radio.
Looking to buy a new home this summer, but it feels out of reach? Then getting on the property ladder just isn't an option for you. Think again. New homes in Haverhill and Cottenham are available now with shared ownership, with your mortgage deposit as low as from £4,000. The final 2 and 3 bedroom homes at Bower Place and Boyton Place also have exclusive incentive packages available worth over £2,500. With £1,000 shopping vouchers, £500 towards your solicitor's fees, and 3 months rent free, book your viewing today to find out what's on offer. Reserve from just £99 and find your new home this summer. Think shared ownership, think Complete Moves. Visit complete-moves.co.uk or call 020 3640 7111 today. Terms and conditions apply.
Need dropping off at work? Miss the bus and must make that urgent appointment? Need picking up after a night out with your mates? Panther Taxis is your Cambridge-based taxi firm with over 700 drivers, offering great rates and local knowledge, ensuring you make it quickly and safely to your destination. We don't inflate our prices at peak times, and all our drivers accept payments by cash or card. Book your taxi the easy way. Download our free Panther Taxis app through your app store and start booking your taxis on the go. Call Cambridge 715 715 or see panthertaxis.co.uk. Panther Taxis, your local, quick, reliable and friendly taxi company in the city.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Rather than books.
And on Bookmark today, we're talking to Chris Whittaker about his novel We Begin at the End. Chris, I said to you before we started recording that the novel made me cry at several points, actually. I don't normally cry at novels. Do you think it's a sad novel? I was thinking to myself, why am I crying? There is a lot of sadness in it. There is a lot of grief in it. And yet there is something else as well.
Yeah, I didn't set out to write a sad book. I just wanted to tell the story of this girl. you know, watching someone struggle, particularly watching a child struggle, is an emotive thing, isn't it? You know, it's it can be difficult to see. And I did a lot of research into some of the stuff that Duchess goes through in the book, and it is not an uncommon thing for children to end up as carers or to end up in the situation she does. And it's really difficult to read, but it is also, you know, it happens, and it happens often, and it's something I wanted to explore. And I get a lot of messages from people saying that they cried and they need to know what happens next. And I just take that as a positive. You know, if you cried because you cared, you know, so that means I've written a character that you can relate to on some level or empathize with, or, and that's me doing my job properly, I guess. And it's hard to think of it as a job, isn't it, right? I mean, it's hard to pay the bills as a writer. So it has to be more, you know, people don't go into writing for money. Like I went into the city for money. You know, this was a completely different thing. This is, you know, it means everything to me.
Even with all this success, and I know that Disney have bought the rights to make a film out of We Begin at the End, you still have another job.
I do. I still have two other jobs. I still, amazingly, still trade in the stock market, which I do every morning. And I still work in the library. I've cut back my hours in the library just because it's been kind of full on with We Begin at the End. We spent years building up to the US launch of the book, and I knew that the PR commitments were going to be, I say they're commitments, they're not, they're just fun. It's just me. So I've done 25 US events so far, and with another 15 or so to go. And it's just talking to people, at the US readers, about the book. And it's so much fun. And it's just getting to meet people that like books is enough for me. You know, that's fun. I always think when someone comes in the library, when I go into a bookshop, I could be friends with that person because they like books. That's all it takes. I've been working 7 days a week for as long as I can remember. There isn't a day where I don't write something. I used to put a lot of pressure on myself to write a certain amount of words in a day, but I've stopped doing that because it's pointless for me, because I can sit there and bang out 1,000 words if I have to, but I know that I'm going to end up rewriting those 1,000 words, and I'm just doing it so I can take the rest of the day off. And I've stopped doing that because it doesn't really help. You know, I'd rather write 250 words that are likely to make it into a first or second edit. To me, that's a good day of writing. But I can't imagine, I just love working in the library. You know, it's my favourite job that I've ever had. It doesn't feel like a job. Everyone is lovely.
And talking about the characters, talking about the book for the US launch, because one of my questions was, how do you, given these characters, particularly Duchess, has been with you so long, how do you leave her behind? I suppose for the minute, you haven't really.
I haven't. So the book is being published around the world over the next 2 years. So she will stay with me. So I'm gearing up for Germany in September, I think, and then France has been pushed to next year, and then there's another 20 countries. It's been really, you know, I've been really lucky with it. I can't imagine leaving her behind. I just can't. And then working with Disney, that will likely take years. So I'm very happy that she will stay part of my life for the foreseeable future, because it will be a sad day when I don't think of her. And I'm not sure it will come either, that day, you know, when something is such a big part of your life. You know, I'm writing the new book and think of Duchess often when I'm telling the new character stories. And yeah, it'll be tough.
Thank you, Chris. You'll stay with me for a long time as well. Let's take a little sidestep now and listen to some poetry. Let's hear from Sue Burge. Sue's first poetry collection, In the Kingdom of the Shadows, was shortlisted for the Live Canon First Collection Prize. Her second full collection, Confetti Dances, is just out. It includes poetry on subjects as varied as modern Russia, the AIDS epidemic, ballet, and lockdown. When I spoke to Sue, I asked her if these different parts and poems were linked in any way.
To me, they form a whole. It's a sort of meditation on universal and personal loss. The book is organised a bit like a ballet. Part one is the kind of journey through quite a dark Eastern European, Russian feeling Europe, a place of exile, a place of difference. Then it goes on to section two, which is the AIDS pandemic and my witnessing of that in the 1980s. And then there's an interlude which looks at the kind of universal loss of the First World War. And then it goes into the third part, which is about my parents who were children of the Second World War, but their parents were children of the First World War. So they would have experienced trauma and loss, and that would have shaped their lives. And then the last part is a sort of coda, and it's got a few pandemic poems in there, but they're not explicitly pandemic poems. You could see them as just poems of meditation on trauma and loss and healing as well. The collection ends on a positive note, I like to think. So
these are very personal poems. I mean, we do have a tendency as readers to put or assume that the I in a poem is the poet themselves, when often it isn't. We wouldn't assume that maybe in a novel, but these do sound like they are personal poems.
Yes, they are. So the I is me, I think, pretty well all the way through.
And how did this collection come about? Did you decide that you were going to write in this order, or you were going to write these things that would link together, or was it gathering together work from the past that you suddenly found had a theme?
It was a mixture. I never quite understand how poetry collections come together. There's a kind of organic process, it seems to me. The kickstart to the whole collection was the poem Bryce that I had in my first collection in The Kingdom of Shadows. And this was a poem about my friend who was a choreologist and who was diagnosed with AIDS in the early 80s and died in 1987. And he was one of the first people in the UK to be diagnosed. And it took me a long time to write that poem. It took me about 30 years to feel I could write about Bryce. And then I think that just opened the floodgates and I started writing more and more about dance and the effect of the pandemic on me personally in terms of witnessing loss. And then I always write a lot about family, and I've always been attracted to a kind of fairy tale, slightly gothic landscape. So somehow all those started to meld together into a whole. But some of them are really new. I only wrote them last year, and some of them are 5 or 6 years old.
And how does it feel putting something so personal out there? I mean, you're talking about your parents, you're talking about friendship and loss.
I think people tend to make the poems their own. Once readers start looking at the poems, they tend to speak to their own experiences. But it is quite frightening. In a way, I don't want to release it, but I think the poems do have to be out there and do have to have a readership to live properly.
And what about form? Are there links between the form? How did you decide what forms to use for what poems?
The poems are in quite different forms. I love using the white space on the page. So to me, the white space is as important as the black space. So a lot of the poems are quite airy. And because the themes are quite, sometimes quite dark, sometimes quite rich, sometimes quite heavy, that white space is quite important to me to let the poems breathe and also to let the readers breathe. I love prose poetry. So a lot of the poems in the collection are prose poems. And although when you hear a prose poem, it can sound just like a line poem, it gives you a certain freedom when you're writing to not have to worry about where the line break's going to be. I use prose poetry a lot, but I don't really premeditate the form. The form either comes as I'm writing or after I've written it.
And this does feel like a collection that comes from maturity.
Yes, definitely. In my 20s, I was writing all those teenage angst poems that are very kind of self-centered. Yeah, this definitely feels like the most mature collection I've written so far.
And you're going to read some for us now.
So I'll start with Scapegoat, which is from the fairy tale Eastern European Places of Exile and Difference. Scapegoat. A witch walks in a forest, dank and deep as famine ache, where children are left to die like kittens in a sack. The forest has many ways, some straight, some narrow, some false, of mudslick, leaf crush, pebbles, breadcrumbs. A witch walks in a forest, where a girl might step from the path to squeeze juice from nettles, ooze from mistletoe, and chew chokeberries with her long yellow teeth. The forest has sealed itself in, canopy heavy as a coffin lid, away from raven call and thunder voice, frost crack and lightning bite. A witch walks in a forest, dragging dark tatters, reaches its dense, briared belly, hears the beat of old hearts, beech, oak, hawthorn. This is where the stories are, scavenged from dark thorn-held visions, an abundance of rings, a worn red shoe, a rolling crimson apple, one throat-shaped bite taken from its flesh. This is where rumours are birthed and rise like wood smoke, whispering of plague, difference, fear. A witch walks in a forest, sips her own spiced saliva, knows how each nest, burrow, den holds its particular dormant alchemy. A witch walks in a forest, not woman, not wife, not daughter. She shapeshifts, tries feather, hide, fur, settles on goat, eyes like split topaz, stakes herself to the forest floor. And the second one I'll read is from the section where I look at the time I spent at the Royal Academy of Dancing and witnessed the effect of the AIDS pandemic. And it's called Obituary for Your Last Pair of Ballet Shoes. Let's start here at the end, how we cradle them heel to toe in fifth position into a cardboard box as gently as if they were hamsters, guinea pigs, or a very small rabbit. Only the air holes are missing. Let's go back to the last day you wore them. No, let's not. Let's go back to the days of those leaps higher than cliff falls, heart-stopping. The days when you wore out so many pairs, they would fill a foreign field. Let's bury these, scarred with twist, stretch and spring at the bottom of this trunk. No, let's not. Let's put them here on this high shelf by an open window, where the first blink of our tears creates an illusory flicker book of flight.
And Confetti Dancers by Sue Burge is published by Live Canon. We've been speaking today on Bookmark to Chris Whittaker about his novel We Begin at the End, which is published by Zaffray. Chris, what's next for you? You alluded to a few things there. Obviously, you're very busy.
Yeah, I'm very busy. So in this summer, The Forevers comes out, my young adult debut. I'm a big fan of YA fiction.
And a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
I've just finished a book called The Maidens by Alex Michaelides. He wrote The Silent Patient, which sold like a gazillion copies and was a mega book. And I really liked it. I thought it was a perfect thriller, that book. So the kind of pressure to follow it is immense. I can't even imagine it, but he's done it and then some, because The Maidens is a great book.
Thank you, Chris. We'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music. But a heads up that our next show, our featured guest is Anna Wharton, talking about her novel, The Imposter. We'll also hear from Anstey Harris on her novel, Where We Belong. And Lewis Elcher will be talking about his book, Traitors or Patriots, about the resistance in Germany to the Nazis during World War II. But we'll sign out now, Chris, with your last choice of music, which is Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel. Why this one?
This is a song that Duchess's mother sings in the book. It's a song that her little brother Robin loves. I listened to this song a lot when I was writing it. It's just the perfect song to describe some of the things that they're going through. And it's a mother-daughter bonding song in the book. Although Duchess, her mum is forever trying to call her up on stage to sing it with her, and Duchess will never do that. She won't indulge her mother. She's just very private and wouldn't want to do it. But she does later in the book, and it's a scene that I quite enjoyed writing.
When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I will dry.